Good morning, I'll read the main hearing. Mr. Williams, you're first. We've read Mr. Young's very brief submissions.
Yes. Yes, I didn't really have a summary as such, given that the evidence was obviously pretty brief, so unless there's anything in particular you want me to take you through, I just welcome any questions or lots of clarification.
One question I have with regard to the issue of the definition of passenger lift systems.
Yes.
In your view as a planner, is it imperative that they go to or from ski areas such as?
It's interesting, I was re-looking at it this morning and it's a question I picked you might actually ask.
Given that the one example in the district doesn't either.
No, it's
true. In fact, it also has a clear look there.
I think when I was thinking about this morning, I actually thought it could possibly consider that it's not really part of the definition. Possibly it was part of that balancing when they're considering in the rural general how they might manage proliferation of ski area lifts everywhere by trying to. You know, there are defined scary subzones, I guess, and so you're effectively managing that risk of them everywhere throughout the district, I would imagine, was the sort of thought behind that. But you're right, it's possibly something that might be better suited in the rule as opposed to the definition. So it could be a...
if you did that, would you think then it might be an outcome that passenger lift systems might have a different activity status within a ski area subzone as compared to outside of one?
Yes, I think so. I think that linking it to the ski area subzone gives, I think, more certainty over where they may potentially arise in terms of under that restriction status as proposed. And I guess that gave some comfort to the council at the time around the effects they might be dealing with. So you're right, it's probably not a matter that determines whether or not it's a superior passenger lift system or not, but whether or not there's maybe greater effects to be considered or a broader range of effects.
Ms. Law, could you just make a note, but I'd like Ms. Leith to consider that issue as well. I should have asked her the other day, but it was one of those things that slipped my mind on Tuesday.
Of course.
That was the only question I had.
I had some questions about natural hazards, but before I go there, can I just follow up on the chair's questions?
Yes.
One thought that went through my mind as the chair was asking me that question is that the current definition of passenger lift system is clearly specific to ski area subzones. That was the point of his question, the current suggested one. Is accepting that there may be different, as you say, different effects, different ranges of effect, depending whether you're within a ski area subzone or without. Is another angle, possibly in combination with that, to make that definition overtly ski area subzone or ski area passenger lift systems, so that you remove the obvious incongruity that the chair is pointing to.
Well, firstly, I guess it's important to note that definition as currently worded provides for ski lifts to ski fields, not just within. I think that's a critical component of the general.
Well, I understand why that's so important to QPL, but in terms, I think you agree that's important, but it's not important or not critical that there in fact be a ski field at the top of the lift system.
So if we start at the start, I think it's appropriate to define what a ski area lift system is, and that probably doesn't really need to be necessarily tied to a subzone or anything like that. So the example being Skyline, that's effectively a passenger lift system. We'll have the same components. We ignore the first part of that definition about the ski area subzone component. It would meet everything else in terms of being towers, pylons, pulleys, cableways, etc. Just like any other lift system within a ski field or providing access to a ski field would. It's just then a matter of what the status of those various systems might be. So currently the district plan recognises that within a ski area subzone, it's effectively provided for the ski area lift system, although it wasn't technically defined previously. And I see another subset of that being a lift system that provides access from outside a ski area subzone, but to a ski area subzone, and then a third set being the remainder being maybe a new, completely new lift to maybe a completely new ski field or, like, I guess, a tourism operation like Skyline, I suppose.
What about if it was to a restaurant on the top of Peninsula Hill? Wouldn't it be, in actual fact, exactly the same activity? It just wouldn't be for the ski area.
Yes,
that's right. Somewhere that would never become a ski area.
That's right. So that falls within the third set that I see being neither within a ski field to a ski field, but simply just a passenger lift system by definition that needs to be appropriately provided for in the district plan provisions.
I'm from Wellington, and of course there it's a feature of the Wellington that there are lots of passenger lift systems to individual service of individual houses up the sides of steep hills. They're not quite as elaborate as a gondola, but they still fit your definition.
That's right, yeah. I think that's appropriate. It's just then how the plan chooses to provide for those passenger lift systems within urban areas is more likely than not going to be permitted, along with most development, say in residential zoning, predominantly it's permitted. Related to residential activity, so I see that probably falling within that ambit. I think really the focus has been passenger lift systems within the context of a rural environment and how we're looking to consider those going forward. And I do think there's a lot of logic and merit in distinguishing a passenger lift system that's providing access to an existing ski field versus the general who knows what might come in to provide, like you see that. A passenger lift system to a new restaurant on top of the National Hill, for example.
Now, can I ask you to go to your evidence on natural hazards, please? The first one I want to talk about is the objective. Council staff have recommended acceptance of your point, and I want to put an alternative proposition, which indeed I put to staff.
Right.
It seems to me that avoidance is a species of management. And so the first question is, would you agree with that?
Yes, I was thinking through those terms again this morning before I came here, and I thought that might come up as well. The management is the more umbrella terminology. I think there's a tendency to distinguish avoidance on the basis that is absolute and most prohibitive, and rightly or wrongly, the term management implies a level of enablement, and possibly it wouldn't be associated with avoidance, and hence why I think typically this that distinction emphasized.
Exact proposition is that it might be rather better if it said avoided or appropriately mitigated, rather than avoided or appropriately managed.
Mm. I guess I see management as more than just mitigating as an option. Management is, you may not always be able to mitigate the effect, or that may not always necessarily be.
I suppose if you can't mitigate it, then requiring it wouldn't be appropriate, would it? If you have appropriately mitigated, wouldn't that cover it?
Sorry?
My point is that the classic form of words is avoid, remedy, or mitigate. I think that most of the time, you can't remedy hazard risk. That's a difficult concept. But if you avoid or appropriately mitigate, if you can't appropriately mitigate, then there is no alternative. Well, if there is, you need to tell me what it is, because I can't think of one.
Well, I think there's a level. I think when it comes to risk, there's a level of tolerance to accept a risk. Say you have a farm building, you may not be in any need to mitigate the risk at all, because that.
I take your point in the staff recommendation, and that's in fact precisely the reason why staff recommended to us we not run with the proposed RPS concept of minimising risk.
Mm-hmm.
But I come back to, isn't that all captured within appropriately mitigating, particularly if, I should say that the staff have also recommended to us that to a tolerable level.
Right, that's in the view.
So that came in through the summary we heard on Tuesday.
Right.
But sorry to keep springing new concepts to you like a three-yard trick.
That's right. Well,
I wonder, when you have a copy of this that was otherwise provided on Tuesday, but it's in here, see what came in. Did a crack changes version of her additional?
Oh, in her, I might have that. In her summary?
No, it was handed up on Tuesday morning.
Oh, was it?
Use mine in the meantime. There might be one on the
back table. I see that I've confused myself because the tolerable level is on the first objective and not the second.
Yes.
So putting that aside, my initial reaction, give you a moment of cap-back, see what we received, the additional changes marked in green. Then I'll pose the question. I can understand. So I can understand the concern that it not be mitigated to the nth degree. And the previous reference to minimised was in the first objective.
Yes.
So I apologise for confusing you still further, just because I was confused. My question is, if it were appropriately mitigated, wouldn't appropriately capture the concept of tolerability? It might, what is appropriate might alter the tolerability, given the other provisions in the natural hazard chapter is clearly one consideration.
Mm-hmm. I suppose the other point that factored into that is that it's risk is the issue. When you raise the point of the farm building, well, risk is minimal on a farm building, so it can then balance the appropriate and risk. That's, I think, where Commissioner Robinson is coming from.
Yes, but I agree that appropriately mitigate is adding an element of like a spectrum clearly indicating that there'll be various means of mitigation from a very complicated situation to very little, and that's associated with risk.
Thank you for that assistance. The other next concept that I wanted to run past you is also get your input. Your discussion of 28.3.1.1. The question I put to Ms. Bogus is, this policy seems very general. Should it actually mention natural hazards somewhere, in some way, shape, or form? And if so, how would you recommend that be done?
Yes, well, I see that every other policy in that suite has referenced natural hazards, so it would seem sensible looking at that. So I would agree that would make sense. It would link it clearly back to what the issue has been, management or consideration of natural hazards. Then the question is where that reference should sit within the policy.
I think that the purpose of the policy is that assets or infrastructure are constructed and located so that in the event of natural hazard risk manifesting itself, potential risk to life and property is, I was going to say minimised, but use that as a, without any pejorative overtones as to what it should actually say, but that's the essence of it, that you shouldn't have unnecessary risk to life or property. I think that's what's behind it, but...
I think actually there's probably two components that it's seeking to address. There's the being sensible about where you might locate the infrastructure itself, but also then the potential for that infrastructure to exacerbate the natural hazard.
Or the consequences thereof.
So I think by looking at the first part of the policy, it's it's suggesting that there's the rip, there is a potential for the infrastructure to be located in such a manner that it might exacerbate natural hazard to human life or property. And I guess that links to the fact that we're talking about regionally significant infrastructure, so it's infrastructure effectively we need to provide for, so therefore there is a scenario where it has to be provided for, yet could have implications for natural hazards on surrounding properties or the like.
That's helpful, thank you. And
I wonder, just taking your point about the two aspects, do you think there might be value in actually pulling that policy apart and making it clear in two separate policies that those aspects are quite clear?
Yes, I think the first part, if you read it, ensure assets or infrastructure are constructed and located as to avoid or mitigate potential natural hazard risk to human life and the potential risk of damage to property. Full stop. That deals with the first element being the infrastructure itself exacerbating or potentially exacerbating natural hazard effects to human life or property. And then the split out would then be the second component being recognition that the infrastructure may need to go where there is a natural hazard, and yet we need to balance that operational requirement with the natural hazard risk, which I think is the second.
So to give you an example that I'm familiar with, State Highway 1 coming into Wellington is on top of a large fault line,
yeah,
because there's nowhere else to put it.
Yes. Yeah.
And no doubt you've come up with numerous examples in the Queenstown Lakes District. But I think, as I understand it correctly, it's a drafting exercise, but your advice to us is that it would be sensible to pick up on the Chair's suggestion and split that out. Of those different concepts out.
Yes, and then I mean looking back at the objective, this is thinking on the fly really, but the objective really is all about the risk of natural hazards to the community and the environment. So therefore the policy really only needs to focus on that interrelationship between infrastructure and natural hazard and the risk it may pose to the form and the environment. It's probably not appropriate under that policy then to deal with the specifics of regionally significant infrastructure and its that balancing between where it needs to go and not in terms of natural hazards. It seems like it's somewhere else.
I suppose the utility providers would have a concern, though I suspect, having heard them at great length on this subject.
Yes, I've heard them in the use mediation as well.
They would have a concern about an apparently absolute obligation on location of natural hazard, location of infrastructure in relation to natural hazards that doesn't recognise the practicality of, as I say, it has to go somewhere.
Yeah, no, that's true. And that's where, in fact, it's defined regionally significant. I mean, to some extent, that probably will expect compromise because of the significance of that infrastructure. Hence, I do support the principle of acknowledging that within reason, the infrastructure has to go roughly where it's got to go because it's that important, and unfortunately, that will come with some compromise.
Effectively, the concept underlying this is that you don't unnecessarily run additional hazard risks.
That's right, yeah. Within, yeah, sensible or practical about it. Yeah.
Now, the other point I just want to run past you is your evidence on the 28.322 that you've supported the 42A report, and the, as you'll see, the advice that we've received is that the previous policy, which is effectively the other side of the coin, be altered to avoid significantly increasing natural hazard risk, which is tracking where the proposed RPS has gone. Do you have an issue with that suggested change?
I see that's the policy above the one that I mentioned in maintenance. There's no reference to the concept of tolerability anymore, or the practicalities of avoidance, which I think are pretty relevant terms when dealing with hazards.
What was that last comment, say, or what avoidance was?
The previous iteration of the policy included the words not always be practicable. I think that's an important term as well in terms of thinking about management of natural hazard risk. I think particularly when you're talking about it's not only referring to development in urban areas anymore either, but particularly in urban areas in the Queensland Lakes District, there are a number of existing urban areas that are within sort of hazard areas, and we just simply have to learn to live with those risks rather than really anything more than that. I guess the town centre is a good example where, you know, effectively everyone's ready to pack up and move out, but we're not going to go and move the town.
The logic that has been put to us is that, as you say, learning to live with it. That's not an increasing risk. The risk is what the risk is.
Mm.
And so the suggested focus is on a significant increase in risk. So, and the reason I'm posing this question about that policy, which you haven't addressed in your evidence, is that I also asked council staff if, because these are two sides of the same coin, whether the first bullet point of the following policy needed to have the same language so as not to fall create a situation that might fall between two stools. Mm. So I think stepping back from the policy, I think what I'm looking for from you, please, is some guidance as to your professional views as to, is a test of not significantly increasing natural hazard risk appropriate, and if it's not appropriate, both why not, and what should it be?
Yes, yep, no, I understand what the question is. I guess my initial thought is that there's always going to be quite a debate as to the measure for what is significantly increasing or not. But I acknowledge that it's clear that it's not about living with a risk, but whether or not we actually make it worse. That's the key focus there, and then I think that's appropriate. You don't want to exacerbate the natural hazard risk any greater than otherwise would be at the moment. But other than that, I can see that there is a merit in making, if that's at some point you've got to say that, you know, that there needs to be a decision made as to whether or not it's appropriate, and it's clear that they're saying avoiding significantly increasing the risk, and that's probably if you, there is a path through that, if that, if you're not increasing the risk significantly, then you wouldn't be sort of challenging that policy.
And just on a no surprises basis, the other proposition I put to council staff was that, again, this policy is put very generally, and there might be any number of other reasons why you wouldn't enable subdivision and development than the natural hazard reason. You might be putting it on an O&L, for instance, and of which there are substantial policy guidance elsewhere in the plan. So the proposition I put was that perhaps enable was too strong. Do you have a view on that?
I think that we're talking about the natural hazards chapter, so I think to try and imply, I guess what you're saying is that you might want to try and hang your hat on the fact that this policy says enable subdivision to then justify putting a house in an ONF. Full stop might be a bit of a stretch, probably.
Do you think there's no one in this district that would try that stretch?
I think that's probably getting a little bit overly precautious. I think we're dealing with natural hazards, and I think it is quite helpful in this district, given a lot of the district has some sort of natural hazard applying to it, or potential to apply, with whether it's faults, floods, that I think it is helpful to recognise that the enabling nature.
The exact proposition I put to council staff was you could get to the same place if it said not preclude.
I just guess, why wouldn't you use a term like enable, given it's got quite a strong reference in the Act? But it's, if there's a concern there, I don't see it being hugely different to suggest the words you've just noted.
Thank you for that, Mr. Williams. Appreciate that.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Say, so there's nothing actually written.
Oh, okay.
It's very short and sharp. So,
right.
My name is Scott Freeman. I'm representing Kanomu Holdings 2014 Limited. Submitted 552 in relation to the definition of visitor accommodation. I've looked at the recommendations in the Section 45 report, and I agree with the amendments to it. So basically, four. Very short reasons. The proposed definition recommended by Ms. Leaf removes the uncertainties within the current definition for the use of centralised facilities within a VA.
Can you speak up a little? I can't quite catch it.
Okay, I'll start again. proposed definition recommended by Ms. Leith removes uncertainties with the current OEP definition for the use of centralised facilities within VA operation. The proposed definition makes it clear that the primary role of VA operation is that of overnight guest accommodation. The use of VA operations for a range of activities, i.e. conferences, meeting functions, council hearings, is very common. It is an historical use that provides a range of benefits to the district. Combining VA facilities to only use by overnight guests is counterproductive due to a range of roles that such facilities perform. So they're my three, four reasons. It's got to support changes that this league has recommended.
Only one, since, again, on a no surprises basis, I asked Ms. Leith the other day whether, in terms of her recommendation, there was an issue with referring to similar scale, since the scale of recreation facilities provided in visitor accommodation could be very large.
Mm.
Because I was thinking of Millbrook with its golf courses, you know, 36 holes of golf course, which is...
Yes. I think the inclusion of and others of similar scale and nature allows a bit of flexibility. You're right, it could be streets to say we've got 15 hectares of a golf course, so therefore we want to have a commercial facility that's 3,000 square metres, so that's comparable or less. So I think I like the flexibility in that. I think the primary thing would be, the key issue is that the primary role of the facility is still for overnight accommodation. If you look at where say a non-overnight, people coming into a site where it could fall outside of the definition of VA as proposed as a standalone business. That standalone business is bigger in size than the VA operation in terms of guest numbers in GFA, and that activity is not accessible for people staying on site overnight.
Do you think, from what you said, that the definition might be improved then by including in the outset the term primarily, so that it said something like the use of land buildings primarily for short term?
Yes.
So to get that concept over the...
No, I agree. So I think pulling forward the word primary, up top would be a good idea.
Submission to the proposed district plan opposed the submission 552 on behalf of Panami Holdings, Limited, which I'll refer to as Panami from here on in. Today I wish to speak against the definition of visitor accommodation that's been recommended to the panel in the section 42A report. That definition incorporates the relief sought by Panami and also by the Arena Propriety, as well as changes sought by the Millennium and Cotswold Hotels, more obviously property developers. I submit that this amended and non-notified definition is ambiguous and thus a substantial departure from both the operative definition and the version that was notified in the proposed district plan. It allows for a significant increase in what can be built or offered to customers by visitor accommodation developments. And it essentially removes all limits to the number and type of people who can use or would use those facilities and services. The potential effects of the recommendation are significant, given that the council is essentially recommending commercial activity under the definition of visitor accommodation, without recommending changes to the matters over which council has control with regards to visitor accommodation. The likely result, as I see it, is that council will be left without the planning tools to manage any actual or potential adverse effects resulting from the implementation of the new definition, in which case it would fail to achieve its functions as prescribed in section 31.1 of the Act. I'll consider the above in more detail, but at this point I'd just like to state the relief that I seek, because I don't get to it yet, that the panel rejects the recommended definition and accepts instead the definition that was notified in the proposed district plan, or if the panel considers that there is merit in the recommended definition, that it notifies the recommended the recommendation as a variation to the proposed district plan, so that people living within and adjacent to a visitor accommodation zone or subzoned land in the wider public can have a chance to submit any changes. And in my opinion, the criteria for bypassing the process in Schedule 1 hasn't been met, as the effects are certainly not minor, nor do they correct any minor errors in the definition. In terms of interpreting an operative definition, I think it's important to look at it because it sort of goes to how far the recommended definition is from what is operative. I'll skip to them. If we assume that the definition was intended to be unambiguous and uncomplicated, then section 2 in the definition simply deals with what may be included under the definition in terms of the buildings and services. And there was a provision for that to be linked to the visitor accommodation activity. Whereas the use of the land, the activity, is defined in the first paragraph, i.e. visitor accommodation means the use of land or buildings for short-term fee-paying, living accommodation, and so on. So that if a person is not using their land or buildings for the purposes of short-term accommodation, then their use of that same land must fall under another category defined in the plan, either recreational or commercial recreational service, community or commercial. And the legal opinions that I've seen, without exception, take this approach, except with regards to the commercial activity, which is what the developers are trying to achieve. If we take the example of Panamu's Humboldt Room, which was the subject of an Environment Court appeal in 2015. The use of that visitor accommodation facility, or conference room, was considered by Simpson Grierson at the request of council. It was considered by two Environment Commissioners and by the Environment Court in a procedural decision. And I've got that at the back of that for you. So all the parties mentioned above considered that using the Humboldt Room for local meetings made the use a community activity, but using the room as a civil defence space was considered a service activity, and therefore it follows logically that using a room for offering or provision of services should be defined as a commercial activity rather than as a accommodation, where the definition is below. So the court didn't make a ruling in this case, but Panama was put on notice that if more than a few persons who were not staying overnight were to use its conference facilities, which was the Humboldt Room, then it might be required to seek a further consent, and I was assuming they meant commercial consent. Judge Jackson also said, I consider at the stage there is no point making a ruling about whether people not staying the night but attending conference would make use of Humboldt Room and commercial activity. But he then went on to say, at first sight, it would. There needs to be evidence that that's likely to happen. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that there is no obvious error in the current definition, nor is it ambiguous. In other words, it wasn't meant to allow for the use of facilities by persons not staying overnight, and the definition doesn't suggest that it does. I think what we have here is an operative definition that doesn't suit property developers, or at least those who have submitted in favour of their amendments, because they would like to do more on their land as of a right and with fewer constraints. And that is exactly what they will get under the recommended definition. I'm concerned about the potential loss of amenity in visitor accommodation zones, and more particularly in visitor accommodation subzones, which are primarily residential. That's because I don't believe council will have the tools with which to control any adverse effects. And by way of example, and I'm giving you a penal example because that's what I'm familiar with, Under the current rules and definitions, commercial activities such as bars and restaurants and small shops are discretionary activity within Glenorchy's physical accommodation. So it's like, and that's on the entrance to town if you've been to Glenorchy. Council can decline any commercial proposal, whether it's within a physical accommodation development or not, that has adverse effects, or they can put in place any number of conditions to avoid or mitigate those effects, obviously because it's discretionary. By contrast, under the recommended definition, bars, restaurants and small shops could be classed as visitor accommodation if they're a part of a visitor accommodation development. And in that case, council will be unable to decline an application so long as they comply with zoning rules and standards. And council's control will be limited to setbacks, access, screening, landscaping and the external appearance of buildings. So matters such as hours of operation will be outside of council's control. And also in this case, the opportunity for public participation and decision making could be reduced due to the shift in activity status from discretionary to controlled. So from the above, the recommended definition would not allow council to meet its prescribed functions under the Act or to achieve the purpose of the Act, which is to promote sustainable management. Thirdly, the recommended definition doesn't do what it's set out to do, and that is remove ambiguity. And I put it to the panel that the use of the phrase primary role is ambiguous in its current context. It sort of sits there without, they sort of missed out adding the facility, I think, in their definition. So where are we? The centralised services can be used for persons not staying overnight, provided the primary role is to service the overnight guests. The primary role of what? Is it the primary role of the overall facility, or is it the primary role of the facility within the facility that the person is using? It's just, I don't think it's clear. And I suggest that others, the phrase, others of a similar nature scale, slightly of course, at least as much debate as there has been recently over the meaning and implications of the word associate within the current definition. So I don't think it goes any way to removing any ambiguity or clearing things up. I think what it basically does is allow developers to sort of get away with potentially more than they would under the current definition. Fourthly, what these changes may well do in some zones is incentivise visitor development at the expense of residential development. So when residential development is in fact what we need in this district. And I'm thinking specifically of residential land within visitor accommodation subzones. So that's what we have on the entrance to Glenorchy, we've got subzone land. But we're starting to see development of that, and if visitor accommodation facilities can include commercial, they become more viable and more valuable than obviously. I'd also like to point out that the costs and issues that I've described above, they were pretty clear. They haven't been, and they're certainly not an exhaustive list. They weren't considered by Council in the evaluation report, and they should have been. The alternative is to retain the operative definition, or choose the notified definition. Under that, the owners of visitor accommodation developments, such as Panama and Verena, they can still, you know, achieve commercial activity, but they're just required as they are now to seek a consent. And through the consenting process, Council will retain the ability to assess and manage any effects of the activity and to turn down activities where significant adverse effects can't be avoided or mitigated. An additional benefit of retaining the commercial consent process for these activities would be that affected parties and the wider public are more likely to get the opportunity to submit on proposals than if the recommended definition is implemented. I'm looking at the definition, I also think it's the addition of C, where the provisions above are otherwise altered by zone rules. So I'm not sure if I haven't sort of looked into that, and, you know, I'm wondering which provisions that refers to. Is it can't be the definitions, it must just be A and B above, or is it the definitions? I thought there was some ambiguity there, but potentially there's the ability, if it refers to the entire thing, it might be possible to alter zone rules and controls in appropriate zones to, in order to free up the use of visitor accommodation centralised facilities for persons who aren't staying on site. Without the owners having to seek commercial consent in areas maybe like, you know, down in sort of in Queenstown where it's busier, but then you allow the townships, which are, you know, really valuing their sort of quiet amenity, to have rules that are appropriate to them. So I think this is a real, really broad brush kind of approach, and it's really permissive, and it doesn't necessarily allow us to achieve what we're trying to achieve in places like the townships or in residential areas within Queenstown, which have visitor accommodation overlays. I think it's curious, just in addition, that the only people that submitted against the notified definition were property developers who visitor accommodation businesses that they're not in commercial areas, they're not in visitor accommodation zoned areas, they're in visitor accommodation sub-zoned areas and in residential areas. And in order for them to get a commercial consent, it's going to be a lot more difficult and a lot more costly. Nobody else seems to have an issue with it, and Dan Penorpia checked on EDOCs and the visitor accommodation businesses that we do have that were in, sort of developed after the implementation of the Act. They do have their visitor accommodation consent, but they also have commercial consents, and Penumbra itself has one for its kitchen, the trading post down by the lake has one for its tiny wee shop, and it just allows council to mitigate any of its effects. So, you know, the comment that Scott made, that he agrees, and I don't think the council made the same comment, but, you know, they're supporting this definition because lots of businesses have commercial operations within their visitor accommodation facilities. That doesn't mean that we should take away the ability of council to manage the effects. You know, they can still do it, they just need to get a resource consent. So that's basically all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Robinson, do you have any
questions? I don't know why.
Yeah.
Is this a matter of scale of the group? Is, so I'll just, I'll just explain what I mean. That if a visitor accommodation, properly so called, has a restaurant and one non-resident dines there in an evening, is that beyond the pale, or is it the number relative to the size of the institution? So if the restaurant seats, well, if the accommodation will accommodate 100 and the resident and the restaurant has 30 non-residents, is that too many? But that's what I'm trying to get a sense of. Is this a bright line?
And I think that's the difficulty. I think Judge Jackson sort of referred to that when he said in his judgment that they're on notice that if more than a few people who weren't staying overnight were to stay, then, you know, they may, you know, need to get a commercial consent. And I think the difficulty with that is that, you know, where do you draw the line? How do you put in place? Is it not easier if you're going to open it up to the general public to go about getting a commercial consent? There's issues with traffic, there's issues with parking. The parking requirements are different for visitor accommodation than they are for commercial. When does council step in and say, okay, well, that's too much now? It's, I imagine if, you know, if you have a conference and you have a few people who happen to be in the town who happen to be interested in their living there, they go along with that. It's not an issue, but I think nobody's going to make an issue of it. But when you have that, when you make it a, you have a separate definition for commercial activity, that mechanism remains in place so that when somebody from the public says, hang on a second, this isn't quite right, now you have 40 or 50 people from off-site using it, and it's tipped balance, they can then apply for an enforcement order, or they can, you know, so by leaving that mechanism there, you don't have the enforcement crew at Queenstown Lakes District Council don't go around and make sure this isn't happening. But if the effects get to the point where they're adverse, then that mechanism's there to deal with it.
So your issue is the slippery slope?
Absolutely. I think we've seen the slippery slope in action in Queenstown before.
Thank you. That's
good. Thank you. Thank you.
I'm going to 11 a.m. tomorrow morning.